You're listening to Go Fish with Mike Buck on AM 690, The Fishing Answer. This segment is being brought to you by the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council at wpcouncil.org. Now, troll on in.
Yeah, you know, sometimes it seems to me that we spend on the council segment of the show lots and lots of months of shows talking about meetings that are coming up and all of the stuff that's got to go into preparing for the decision makers, the materials for the meetings. That's kind of a big way to boil it down. But as you know, last week we talked to Marlo Sabater, one of the council scientists. He's to do with the environmental and the ecosystems of fishing. Today, Mark Fitchett's back. And Mark and I we're kindred spirits because we both like pelagics. And I just take it for granted. And by the way, we're going to impart to you what happened in this 178th meeting with regards to the pelagics, because like not only are they our favorites, but they're also the meat and potatoes part of the whole thing that we do here at the council. So with that, but before we start on the pelagic, Mark, first of all, welcome back. Nice to see you again.
Good to see you too.
And secondly, we had the opportunity to spend with Marlo a nice discussion on Kona crabs, and you were, even though you're a pelagics dude, you were involved in the data research for the Kona crab stock assessment. Pretty encouraging what came out of that, isn't it?
It is. You know, we've, you know, based on the prior work that was done about I think it was 2010, 2015, prior assessment showed, you know, concluded that the stock was pretty much depleted.
Yeah. Surprise.
Because the trend in CPUE had gone down.
CPUE?
Catch per unit effort. Okay. Sorry. That's catch rate.
Yeah, yeah.
So in fishery science, we use catch rates to build sort of an indicator of abundance. And catch rates don't always indicate abundance, as we know.
Mm-hmm.
Throughout the years, we had experienced a lot of experienced Kona crab fishermen leave the fishery in the 70s.
And not be replaced.
Yeah, so there's a lot of local knowledge that was not replaced. And we were able statistically to show that when we had individuals leave the fishery, catch rates just kept going down and down and down. When in reality, that the total catch, the amount of biomass being removed, was very small. When you're talking about tens of thousands to just, you know, less than 10,000 pounds of a crustacean removed a year, that's not a lot of biomass.
Interestingly enough, and we learned a little bit about this, it's not all things are created equal, and we can't have an impact. For instance, when I found out years ago that they had to release the females. Okay, number one, release the females. Number two, keep the big males. And when that happened, it didn't really balance the moms and the dads down on the bottom.
No, and what happens, and I don't think this, I don't, what I'm about to say, I don't think it happened to the Kona crab stock, because there've been so few individuals relatively removed.
Yeah, how can we do that, you know?
But if you're removing if you remove just the males and you have just spawning females, you have what's called an allele effect, which is essentially you have skewed sex ratios. And so not only are you removing a disproportional number of individuals, you're preventing them from being able to mate successfully. One thing that's interesting is that if you remove all the large males, what happens is, male Kona crabs, it's kind of funny, right? They have to be big and strong enough to bury out the female to copulate, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's kind of funny to think about it if you've got a lot of
little guys and big women, you know?
I was going to say that. He beat me to it. But it doesn't always work, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. So that kind of could happen if you remove all of if you target just large males,
right?
And so biologically, you can actually create a problem with that.
It's so interesting to me, because we're trying to paint the picture on the radio in a mind's eye of this little Kona crab guy trying to be on mounting this big Kona crab lady, and it just didn't work. And you know, and so that there, but my point was, how can such a small harvest impact something?
In some cases, if you have animals that are very slow growing, mm-hmm. and let's say they don't reach sexual maturity until then you could you know, lead to local extirpation or deplete a resource very quickly. Mm-hmm. If you are removing your pre-spawning individuals.
Okay, so the good news is, basically, so that we can move on to our pelagics, which are my favorite, as you know, is we got to make sure that we establish the fact that new numbers justify a bigger take, and that is going to hopefully create a bigger demand and maybe even create some more commercialization of the Kona crabs, because it looks like they're there and ready to harvest.
Correct. Yeah, and another thing is they don't catch. You don't get a lot of bycatch species with Kona crab.
No, good point.
You don't get any protected species catch. It's almost a directly targeted fishery, and yeah, there's room for growth. And even if you look at the number of pounds that are removed a year, it's still not even anywhere near the quota that is being set or that has been recommended.
Yeah, interestingly enough to me on
ACL,
that.
Sorry.
Interesting to me on that was that, you know, we can take a look at, you know, if somebody can find out they can make a living at it, then they have to create a market. Once they've created a market, you have to guarantee the guy buying the stuff that you're going to keep fishing.
Right.
And right now, that's a small number.
And, you know, the other thing about Kona crabs is that it takes a long time to eat. I like them. They're delicious. You can cook them Chinese style. You can do like we do in North Carolina and have a low country boil with them. You can do a lot with them, but it's a festive food, right? You sit around with the family on a long picnic table with, you know, the newspapers
get that
down.
On and get the newspaper and just, down and go for it.
Yeah. And, you know, and have a couple beers and eat them and make it a multi-hour affair.
Yeah.
But what it seems like a lot of the seafood demand here, especially for tourists, you know, I don't think a lot of restaurants really serve them because it is sort of it takes a long time to eat. You know?
Yeah. So. Okay, now speaking about a long time to eat, let's talk about the long time and the agreements and some of the things that came up that affected your and my favorite, and that is the pelagics. And let's remind everybody, because I often assume that everybody listens is an expert, right? What is a pelagic fish, and why? What makes them different from, say, fish that you catch on the shore?
So pelagic fish, what we designate as a pelagic, is essentially anything or any organism that occupies the upper water column.
Yeah, I've always heard it's a surface running game fish.
It's a surface running game fish. Now, you can be quasi pelagic. Some people say, well, some people will argue that there are pelagic tendencies of fish like uku, for example. And so there's things. So people could say that there or like a cobia back east, we'd say is a pelagic or a kahala, but in reality, from an official fishery standpoint, a pelagic fish is one that, for the most part, migrates and spends its entire life in the upper water column.
Yeah, and that means that most of the pelagics are big,
and
they move. And the interesting thing is, like I said, that we are our fishery here, the longline fishery, is a pelagic fishery. And whether it's the big eye or the yellowfin or the opah or whatever it is, or the swordfish, it's their surface game, most of them.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay, so that means that 90% of what we do at the council level has to do with pelagics.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it, what we do, I mean, so there's, you have the insular fisheries that you've talked to Josh and Marlo that they handle,
which
are important. I would say a local and cultural importance, and then you have the international fishery out of here, which is what I work on tunas. But at this last meeting, we had a lot of points that were discussed. There were some issues on the west coast of the United States that are of interest to us here in Hawaii that came up, including the opening of a deep set buoy gear targeting swordfish.
Yeah, targeting swordfish
in California.
Yeah.
That was of interest. We had our big eye tuna long line allocation and specifications, which I'm sure you're going to ask me on here in a minute.
Oh, yeah.
And then we also have some international meetings that I attended back in May prior to our last time I was here in the studio.
Okay, so that means, and by the way, what I was talking about before is some of these assessments and some of these this fact gathering stuff takes months. And, you know, it gets compiled, and at the last minute, it gets into the right hands at the right time to make decisions. And that's what happened, right? Particularly with what we're talking about, the Big Eye decision and who can catch them and what the limit should be. They should be a lot higher than they've been.
Right. And so, you know, one of the issues that we have here in Hawaii is that our fishing capacity has not been fully realized. Mm-hmm. What I mean by that is we have 160 long line permits of about 140 to 145
active
boats.
Yeah.
Some of which we're getting a couple relocating to California now, which has been an issue going into San Diego. So we have this very dynamic system here, and we've never at the commission level. The U.S. longline fleet has never been given, and for all intents and purposes, really a fair share mm-hmm. of the international quota. Most of the fishing effort and capacity mm-hmm. has been geared towards the Asian countries.
Yeah.
And then you have the small island developing states, and that's
sure.
and this is an important
for us
thing to consider.
Right?
The small island developing states do not have catch limits.
Mm-hmm.
Because they are developing and in part of the WCPFC, which is the Western Central Fisheries, sorry, the Western and Central Pacific Fisheries Commission, which sort of is the, we call it a regional fisheries management organization. So the WCPFC, as we call it.
It gets confusing, gang. It's not the council.
Yeah.
It's another organization. It sounds a lot similar.
Yes, that's true. Yeah. And that organization controls all international quota.
Mm-hmm.
And right now we have roughly, top of my head, 8,000 metric ton quota for China. And that's assuming that China is reporting everything.
Yeah.
And I say that
in
jest.
That's a mystery. Yeah, it's a guess. Yeah.
You know, Korea about the same. Japan has a quota of about 17,000 metric tons, but only has been harvesting between 11 and 12,000. And then Indonesia, which has a quota of 6,000 metric tons, has only reported in 2017 13 metric tons.
Yeah, wow.
So, which is not a lot of. No. I mean, put it this way: we were harvesting more Kona crab back in the 90s than what Indonesia has been reporting on tuna. You know, put that in perspective, right? So, you know, this creates these issues that Hawaii has not been able to fully realize its fleet capacity under the quota which is given to it.
Okay.
And our quota is 3,500 metric tons here in Hawaii. Mm. And so, therefore, the U.S. Hawaii-based longline fishery has agreements, has specified agreements with our territories, which are considered SIDs, as I mentioned, or participating territory, that by WCPFC standards does not have a catch limit.
Mm-hmm.
So what we did, what the council did in 2014 was give them a catch limit and say, okay, you have a catch limit, but we're going to allocate X amount to the U.S. longline fishery so we can, you know, fully fish and reach our demand. And then on top of that, the U.S. longline fishery will pay via an undisclosed amount to these territories.
Yeah, by the way, gang, it wasn't necessarily that the money's paid to these smaller guys was for developing longline, although that's the desire. Some of it was just giving them boat ramps and giving them ice machines and giving them stuff for their fishery. That since they couldn't catch the fish that we wanted, we'll catch the fish and then we'll give them money to go expand and improve their fishery.
And fish what they want to fish for. And as we know,
species and everything we're talking.
Yeah, right. And America Samoa, which also has the second larger longline fleet right now, I think they have about 14 active vessels and one Aaliyah boat fishing out of America Samoa targeting albacore.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been hamstrung with issues in America Samoa with local, I would say, arbitrary and capricious regulations to them based from the America Samoa government. So they've been restricted on where they can fish. And on top of that, China has been increasing its albacore catch at a God knows how much rate. And yeah. last year, 2017, the last fully reported year that we have at the WCPFC, 46,000 metric tons, 46,000 metric tons of albacore, South Pacific albacore.
That's
harvested.
A huge number.
They took in half of the catch.
Yeah, by the way, I was going to say, by the way, sometimes, and this is where you got to understand, gang, the whole ocean is mapped out in whose water is whose.
Right.
And sometimes this big fleet that we're talking about, the other guys, they're right outside ours. And, you know, our economic zone of fishing, right?
Yes.
They're not supposed to fish there.
And so for listeners to understand, we have, so U.S., Hawaii and the U.S. participating territories, Guam, CNMI, America, Samoa, 200 miles outside of off their land,
right.
That is sovereign water,
right?
So that is territorial water,
which
or
means
Hawaii
if you're
water.
Not, if you're fishing in there, you're fishing illegally.
And you, yeah. exactly, yeah. unless you have unless you have permission or whatever.
Yeah.
On top of that, we have our atolls like Rose, Palmyra, Johnston, yeah. all these islands, Midway, Wake, that are U.S. territories or U.S. Prias, Pacific remote island areas, 200 miles outside of those are also U.S. waters. And so we, the council, that's under our purview. Mm-hmm. And so it's funny you mentioned the gauntlet of fishing effort outside of our EEZ. Global Fishing Watch, and I would encourage the listeners to go on their phones or to go online and look up Global Fishing Watch. We invited them to come to our council meeting and then to the Fishers Forum and to give a presentation. Mm. And what they are able to do is using AIS, which is essentially a beacon on all the fishing boats.
Right. So we know where they are, where they're fishing,
where they're fishing.
Stuff,
yeah. And some of that is public domain data. Mm. And on top of that, they are using types of radar that can essentially locate individual boats that don't have VMS or AIS turned on.
Wow.
So they're able to map out what they call it the dark fleet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and so Global Fishing Watch, there are some caveats there. There's some limitations, but their intentions are good. But when you look at, if you were to take a snapshot, and I encourage the listeners to go on and check it out, play around with the tool. I think you have to register, whatever. It's free. You can access it. Look at the map of Hawaii's economic exclusive zone, and then it's like lit up like a Christmas tree.
Yeah, yeah.
200 miles offshore.
Yeah, I'm
and those are Taiwanese boats. Mm-hmm. These are Japanese boats. Mm-hmm. These are Chinese boats. These are boats from all over.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Hawaii Longline fleet, because it cannot fleet fish in most of the EEZ of the economic exclusion zone, has to compete outside in international waters.
Pretty tough.
And and on top of that, you know, there isn't much spatial allocation of effort going on. It's pretty much a free-for-all. Well, I shouldn't say it's a free-for-all, but there's essentially not any specifications or regulations dictating, you know, how much fishing effort can be exerted in X place, except for within the EEZs.
And now that 178th meeting is over, gang, go to wpcouncil.org and see different ways that you can explore what happened and get a little bit more in-depth coverage. So that's wpcouncil.org. Very important that you do that, just so that you know what we're talking about here. And it's fascinating stuff. And it'll give those of you that even think that, well, I'm not really interested in that, if you take a look at it, you will be. I think it's pretty fascinating that, and it's unfortunate in many respects, Mark, that and once again, Mark Fitch is a scientist here, so he wants to do the science. But it also ends up being half science and half politics.
Hell, a lot of politics.
You know, it's really unbelievable.
Yeah, and it's been a baptism by fire, as we'd say, you know, back home. You know, you're dealing with something that's a highly contentious issue.
Yeah.
And then, so as you mentioned at the council meeting, what we had done is because the WCPFC rules on that there's no territorial limits.
Mm-hmm.
We actually had voted prior, the council and NOAA had put in action to make the territorial specifications more flexible so they could multiple year agreements, and also lifted the requirement to have a catch limit for the territories.
You know, we've actually had this conversation in different shapes in different times. And my question always has been, you know, we keep adding more people to the planet. To the planet, you know. I mean, our internationally, our population is expanding, and therefore our need for food and everything else is expanding. It's not logical to think that the fishery can keep taking. You know, you can keep taking fish to feed this growing group unless you do some very proactive things about catch limits and resting and all of that stuff.
Right.
It seems to me that if this were all to go unchecked, you could virtually outfish an area, and it would happen.
Yeah, and it's happened. So you have spatial. So that brings up a good point. So most people here in Hawaii are familiar with the longline fleet.
Sure.
What people, I don't think a lot of people realize is you have small boats here at Fish in Hawaii. They're very important.
Mm-hmm.
And then on top of that, you have a massive fleet down the equatorial waters, which is about 10 south to 10 north. So you have this big belt, equatorial belt.
Which is where the fish are.
And that's where a lot of skipjack tuna are. And presumably a lot of subadult big eye tuna.
Mm-hmm.
And so the purseine fleet, which we're talking vessels that can essentially harvest 15,000, you know, metric tons in a year, mm-hmm. right? They go offload. I mean, you've had, I mean, that's an extreme case, but you have these vessels which are huge, and their hull capacities are just massive.
They don't care about fresh either, by the way.
Well, skipjack, it's a different beast.
Yeah.
Skipjack tuna are extremely productive.
Mm-hmm.
Aku, we call here, they're extremely productive. They've been able to withstand heavy amounts of harvest and still be able to replenish. Mm-hmm. However, when they catch adult skipjack in the purseine fleet, they incidentally catch juvenile subadult big eye tuna.
Okay.
And so,
which is a real problem.
And so when the stock assessment scientists did their, and this is kind of where I get into to the bread and butter of what I do, the stock assessment scientists produced the stock assessment of big eye tuna and showed that the juvenile fishing mortality, which are subadult,
mm-hmm.
presumably taken from the Indonesian and Filipino ring net and surround net fishery and the purseine fishery, where they target the small individual, the rat, big eye tuna, that has a fishing mortality rate that is double that of the adults.
Mm-hmm.
So from a scientific standpoint, when you look at reduction in spawning potential, and then what spawning potential is if you are fishing, if a fishery is exploiting a resource, how much ability, how much reproductive capacity are you inhibiting? And the purseine fishery has a profound impact when, relatively speaking, the longline fishery, particularly those in the northern latitudes where we are minimal.
Yeah, and you know, you have to look. Every now and again, you take a look at like the deadliest catch, and you know that when they bring in these potfuls of crab, they're able through the process of putting them down in the hold of separating the juveniles, and they do that. There is, I don't think, anything scientifically that could be done so that they could process something they catch in a big, you know, drift net and make sure that the babies get out. I mean, that's not even on there. They're targeting the babies. They want the babies.
Well, they want the skipjack tuna.
Yeah.
And incidentally, they get big eye, small big eye, which I don't think really even have a big market value. Maybe somebody can correct me if I'm wrong. Mm. You know, the price per pound is not even that great, but it's an incidental catch.
Yeah.
Because they school together, right?
But the thing that's hard to understand is, and by the way, gang, we don't want to take it for granted that everybody knows, but aku or skipjack doesn't travel very well. So it goes from usually, if you're going to eat it fresh, it goes from the boat to your mouth the same day or two days. But these big ships that we're talking about, they're catching aku or skipjack by the tons, and it is going into a process where it's frozen immediately.
Yeah, they put them in these brine tanks, these like slurry of salt water and ice, and then they go in and they're frozen pretty much. And there's some purseine boats that also that can process them on board, which is interesting. I mean, it's kind of a fascinating operation.
We were worried at one time that there was a talk underway a decade or two ago about getting a canning ship, a ship that would actually process and can the fish on the ship.
That would be a labor nightmare.
Oh yeah, oh yeah.
How would you? Would you want to be on that boat and work in that cannery? No.
Yeah. But the point is that why is all of this done? And in many respects, we can knock on wood and thank the lucky stars that even though it is contentious and political, that there is, I guess, agreement that we need to agree that we that even the worst taker has got to be held responsible to some sort of quota system.
Yeah, and the Persein fleet right now,
which we don't have, by the way,
we don't have
anywhere near our waters.
We don't have anywhere near us here in Hawaii, by the way. That's all in the equatorial regions. And so the Persein fleet, you know, there are restrictions, there are closures, but there's ways to circumvent, you know, ways to wait. There's ways to make up for lost time and for closures that the Persein fleet is able to do. And that's not to demonize. I mean, and don't. So I don't want the listener to hear. Oh, the you know that I'm, you know, throwing shade on the Persein fleet because they are an important fishery and they do there are certain Persein fleets are able to sustainably harvest resources to target specific species. They've done magic in reducing bycatch of turtles and of dolphins.
Yeah.
However, the volume of biomass that is removed from Persein fleets is almost on an effort scale is not even incomparable. And about half of the big eye catch caught in the Western and Central Pacific Ocean is big eye catch.
Yeah,
and
by
in
the way,
EPO, it's the same story. In the Eastern Pacific, it's more than half caught in the Persein fishery.
Okay, to those of us that love the big eye and the ahi, having it called bycatch is somewhat bothersome because it's the ideal that what we want, what many of us want. Why is it not just incorporated into the skipjack catch? I mean, it is tuna.
It is caught tuna, and they do sell it, and it is, you know, so they do process it and sell it. So it's not wasted.
But it's not what they're looking for.
But it's not the high-quality fish that we have here in Hawaii.
Right.
We have our small boat fleet here that they...
They just take care of their fish.
They produce those fish are high quality, excellent product. The longline fisheries up there too, here in Hawaii, very good, a good product. They're able to offload quickly, be processed here at the auction here. It's an amazing process that they can bring a fresh product they do.
Getting a chance to see that, you really ought to. And, you know, Mark Fitchett and I, Mark's a scientist, and I'm the radio guy. We go on for hours on this. I want you to go to wpcouncil.org and really look into the fruits of the labor because I do know that you guys would just go from one project to another and the meeting's done and now you're running.
Yeah.
Because you got to, there's going to be another one.
I'm going to Taiwan on Tuesday.
So, what's happening there?
So in Taiwan is the ISC, which is the International Science Committee for tuna and tuna-like species. So they handle most of the stock assessments in the North Pacific.
Okay.
And they work some in the East, but the big one this year is North Pacific striped marlin.
Mm-hmm.
And like we've mentioned in prior shows, there's some biological issues with some of the stock definitions spatially.
Yeah, yeah.
We discussed that in the prior shows. Genetically, there may be a North Pacific stock that could be connected from Japan to California, but we're only in the stock assessment. We're truncating. We're not even considering the fish in the Eastern Pacific.
We haven't we learned in the last couple of decades that a lot of the previous assumptions of what the tuna fishery was has changed. In other words, we've come to realize that here in the main Hawaiian islands that we have our own yellowfin. And we might have our own big eye.
We might have our own big eye. That is a possibility. And one of the things that we're trying to do on a project with Peter Grew in Australia, and actually we're trying to get...
To tag some of these things, right?
We're looking at genetics.
Yeah.
So we're looking at how...
Oh, yeah, of course.
So we're building a mosaic across the Pacific to see how many parental pairs, or I'm sorry, how different are the parental units between young... Big eye tuna here caught, and we've been catching a lot of. We've been getting samples from our small boat fishery that do get the rat big eye, right?
Yeah.
The small ones. And so we're connecting those to see how genetically similar are they to those caught in the central North Pacific where we are versus those in the equatorial and throughout the entire Pacific.
You know, you'd think we'd have the whole thing wired, but we're actually just getting our eyes open, right?
Yeah, and,
it's so exciting.
And these fish even grow differently from place to place. Yeah. And we've seen that with striped marlin, as we have smaller stripers here in Hawaii. Yeah. And so if you're assuming growth of a striped marlin caught, let's say, in Taiwan, where they're much bigger and they're biologically maybe a different beast, that growth information may be misspecifying the productivity
of
the stock.
To me, that's fascinating. And many, many know that stripies around the main Hawaiian islands, they're dinkos in compared to what in other places. They run like rain sometimes. They're all over the place.
Yeah.
But for some reason, we don't see the large striped marlin in Hawaii. That means they're going somewhere else.
You do get a unicorn every now and then that comes in that's big, that's like 120, 100, 100, 150 pounder. You know, those could be transients coming from, you know, the west, coming from
big.
The south.
Yeah, yeah.
We've had a fish that was tagged here, I think a 90 pounder that Tim Lamb and Molly tagged that went from just east of Hawaii all the way down to the Coral Sea.
Unbelievable.
So, but when we draw the stock lines, we're not including what are south of the equator. So, you know, there's all these inconsistencies in what we know biologically about striped marlin. And the other thing that's interesting is a colleague of mine, Bob Humphreys, who's retired over at the Pacific Islands Fishery Science Center, finished a maturity study. And he found that, you know, we have these two groups of male fish, what appears to be higher percentages of male fish in, let's say, the early and late months of the year.
Huh.
And so that would...
Go figure.
That could be because you have spawn. You could be having spawning males and females coming in and out. And on top of that, that month where you start to see the sex ratio change, that's when you start to see that orange-colored...
That slick.
When you have striped marlin poke, you get that pink-orange, type of color.
I've seen that.
And so that could be due to maybe a... Who knows? Mm-hmm. That could also be due to fish eating something else moving into the eastern Pacific. So when you look at the conventional tag data... From let's say California, all those fish that were tagged in California and recovered in the Hawaiian waters happened during those months.
That's fascinating.
During that March to July period, where your sex rate ratios change. That could be due to some sort of migration. We don't know.
Okay.
So
before we run out of time, though, I want to get back into your takeaway from the meetings, because I do know, particularly in the way you do the assessments, a lot more science was presented to the decision makers. And what we're talking about is, was your takeaway that it was productive and that there were a lot of people outside of the inner core of scientists that you are that can use some of this information to be, I don't know, I was going to say not necessarily more liberal with catches, but to realize that our stock, it's in pretty good shape.
Right. And I think even our colleagues at NOAA, the National Marine Fisheries Service, our colleagues on the SSC, the Science and Statistical Committee, which are scientists from all over the world, they all agreed at both the SSC meeting and then also at the council meeting, our council members, which, by the way, come from small boat fisheries.
Right.
They represent the auction.
Big,
so they're across the board. It was unanimously that it was saying, well, okay, rather than have a 1,000 metric ton allocation agreement between each territory, it's probably high time to get rid of the catch limit for the territory, so they can, if they want to fish whatever, do whatever they want in their territory under the guidelines of the commission. But on top of that, increase the allocation limit between Hawaii and the territories from 1,000 metric tons to 1,500.
Yeah, which, by the way, doesn't sound like much. It's a lot.
It is
a lot.
And it
does make a big difference.
It gives a little bit of wiggle room for the fishery. Right now, in Hawaii, our longline fishery has been catching the last month. The volume of product has been monumental. It's been unprecedented.
Mm-hmm.
Talking to Eric Kingma with the Hawaii Longline Association, they had almost a backlog of boats offloading. Price per pound does see a drop. It does, and it can create some sort of economic issues there. But, you know,
it also presents an opportunity, because once you know that the catch can go up, your marketing effort can go up too.
Right. And that's true. And you know, and that builds some opportunity for the folks down at the auction block at the fish house. But also, it's a wake-up call that the quota that we have here, the 3,500 metric ton quota, we're expected to hit in August, right?
So, so what happens the rest of the year? No fishing.
No fishing. Yeah, so we need these specified agreements in order to keep the fishery running so they can have product at the end of the year.
Which
when
is
we know,
when we need it, when the demand is huge, at Christmas and New Year's.
Exactly. Yeah, so rather than relying on frozen product from elsewhere. Yeah. And so, you know, it's good to have a U.S. product that is that is in the market. And that is kind of was a takeaway. And it does not have a discernible conservation cost to the stock as
a whole. There's the key, and that the word discernible. So generally, all in all, were you somewhat pleased that it was a productive get-together and the decision-making will be good?
It was a productive meeting. I had a lot on my plate. Last Wednesday, I was behind the mic probably more than people really wanted to hear me. We talked about the Big Eye tuna allocation. Yeah. We talked about the international meetings. Mm-hmm. We had it was a very productive meeting. It was probably the busiest one that I've had yet since my friend Eric left. Mm-hmm. You know, I've been taking on a heavy load. Yeah. So,
well, safe travels, and we'll see when you get back. We'll talk about it some more.
Sure.
And if you want to hear something on the program here, you know what to do. Drop us an email to themikebuckshow@gmail.com. But you really need to go into the wpcouncil.org website. And these reports are all trickling their way out there. And there's it's just great. The results of the meeting generally looked favorably upon. So until next time, have a great weekend. Those of you celebrating the 4th of July weekend, go catch some fish. Have some fun. See you next time.